You're listening to Campus Review Radio.
Welcome to HeadX, hosted by Martin Betts. This podcast explores the changing landscape of the higher education sector. Welcome to the Higher Education Experience.
Welcome to another episode of HeadX, everybody. And our episode this week is the third of four extracts from the HeadX conference, Changing Higher Education for Good, that took place on March the 21st in Melbourne. We had some great sessions in the last two episodes that included sector leaders' reactions to the University's Accord final report in Australia. And last week, an excellent session kicked off by a keynote from Michael Crow of Arizona State University that was followed by a very diverse equity panel thinking of the genuine way that we might accelerate towards social justice in all aspects of work that we do in global universities. And the third of four that we'll be listening to this week has some excellent inputs from technology leaders in universities and in companies providing technologically based services to the higher education sector globally. And started off by a really excellent session from Josh Nestor, the Managing Director of Seek Investments, heavily involved in leading, identifying, implementing, and bringing to success and realisation some major investments by global funds in global education technology, university and other ventures serving the needs of lifelong learning. So welcome to this episode of HeadX, and I hope you enjoy the start of the episode with this conversation taking place on stage between myself and Josh Nestor. Because you're the Managing Director of Seek Investments, and who are they for the benefit of the room? Who are you? What has been and is your relationship with Seek, which is not the same company? And how would we all know Seek Investments from the Australian higher education system, Josh?
Sure. Hi, everyone, and thank you for having me, Martin, and thanks for everyone to join. I can't tell you how refreshing and inspiring it is to be in this room talking about this topic with a bunch of Australian leaders, because over the last 6 weeks I've been talking about the future of higher education with a bunch of Latin American leaders and North American leaders in Mexico as well as in India. And so to be in a room full of Australian thought leaders, a community of people who are passionate about education and about the opportunity and to change for good is really, and I realise that I'm standing in between you all and lunch. To the question, who is Seek Investments? Probably most of you haven't heard of Seek Investments. You've obviously, I think, would have heard of Seek. We started 2.5 years ago. We're an independent private company actually founded by the founder of Seek and the former or co-founder of Seek and former CEO Andrew Bassett. We are a relatively, even though we're 2.5 years old, we're relatively large. We're a $2 billion investment fund, or we run a $2 billion investment fund called the Seek Growth Fund. Seek is a major investor in the growth fund alongside external investors. And we invest in two things primarily, or pretty much only two things. One is HR, technology, and the other is education. I'm not saying ed tech because we invest in a bunch of things, including universities, but HR and education are our sole focus. And the other thing that's unique about our fund is that we're what you call an evergreen fund. And what that means is that when we invest in something, we don't have to think about exiting within, say, a 5-year timeline or a 10-year timeline. We can take a long-term view. And that's actually quite unusual in the world of investment, and we're extremely fortunate to be in that position. And so we invest in a bunch of Australian and global companies, about 25 roughly in total, across HR and education. In terms of the companies that you might be familiar with, in an Australian context, OES is one of our partners, GoOne is one of our partners, and then I guess more globally, you may be familiar with Coursera. That's one of our portfolio companies. And some others that are really, really interesting that you wouldn't have heard of that we can go into details on in Latin America and India and other places.
Fantastic, Josh. And you talked there about taking the long-term view. I guess that's been pretty helpful given what we've been through in the last 3 years or so. And I wonder how Seek Investments are seeing coming out of that last 3 years, what the current landscape of not just Australian but global ed tech activity across that whole K-12 and tertiary education sectors looking like after everything that we've had thrown at us. What's the long term look like for you after the last 3 years?
Well, you see that my hair has turned grey, but thankfully I've still got some. It's been a wild ride the last couple of years. And, you know, if I reflect, I've been really investing in this space for about 20 years. Firstly, with Seek Limited, now with Seek Investments. And we've seen a steady increase in investment every year. Through COVID, we saw this enormous spike in investment, sort of a doubling of investment in global ed tech, driven by, you know, a lot of relief funding, the shift to emergency remote learning, record low interest rates. And then coming out of COVID, if we can say that, we're kind of still in it, but, you know, there was this sort of snap back the other way, and a lot of the relief funding ended, interest rates went up, and you've always got this interplay between structural factors and cyclical factors that play out in any market, and in certainly in education more broadly. You know, we're seeing on one hand structural factors such as the shift to lifelong learning, demographic declines in terms of traditional student segments globally. We're seeing, I mean, in a place like America, you mentioned K-12, I think absenteeism is now, 14 million students that miss 10% of school days in the US. So really significant sort of structural factors, both positives and negatives, if you like. The rising middle class in emerging markets is a huge structural opportunity for all education providers, and Michael talked about the 35 million, I think it might be more like 40 million Indian people looking for a higher education that don't have access to one. And then you've got the cyclical factors, right? So clearly cost of living pressures are a challenge. We are at full employment more or less as well. And so we're in this weird place where you've got inflation rising and costs rising and economies getting a bit tougher, but also full employment. And that's had an impact on enrolments. So, new enrolments in Australia in higher education are down. In general, B2C enrolments in ed tech all around the world are down, compensated by sort of some strength in enterprise enrolments. And really, you know, the companies that are doing maybe better at the moment are those that are tackling real problems, kind of human problems, if you like. Things like teacher shortages, things like student welfare, things like how do you reskill and upskill your workforce. These are companies that are attracting investment now, even in a difficult climate. And if we talk about AI for a moment, you know, AI in education hasn't attracted the huge investment that AI and technology companies generally have attracted, but they are getting some traction. You know, there has been seed funding raised by AI-driven edtech companies at kind of modest valuations or modest premiums to normal valuations. There's a lot of opportunity there, but we're still in this sort of tricky moment.
Tricky moment, and a tricky moment when you're briefly back in Australia after a bit of a world tour. You're always on a world tour, it seems, with the way that your role's playing out. You've mentioned OES and Go One as two companies that you're investing in Australia. I mentioned Southern New Hampshire, which I know fits in your portfolio as of interest as well. And you've mentioned Brazil, Mexico, India, or at least I know you are active in Brazil, Mexico, India. Can you tell us a little bit more about where Seek Investments is investing in higher education and edtech around the world and why you've chosen some of those partners?
Sure. So I guess to fill in some of the blanks, you're all familiar with OES and probably with Go One, a short course aggregator and corporate LMS company that's based out of Brisbane and serving a global market. But if we kind of look more broadly, I mentioned, and go region by region maybe, in Latin America, we invested several years ago now in what is now the largest pure online university in Mexico, has well north of 100,000 students studying with them. And what's unique about UTEL, which is the name of it, is that it's a university in its own right, but it also enables other bricks and mortar universities in Mexico and outside of Mexico and other parts of Latin America to go online as well. So leveraging what it's learned over the last decade and a half to help other institutions go online through partnership. And partnership's a key thing that we should come back to. Another really interesting portfolio company is Alura in Brazil. We invested in Alura way back in 2015 when it was a classroom-based IT certification business. It then moved online to offer tech training skills online, but all unaccredited. And then more recently, we actually reversed engineered the model and went and bought a technical focused university. So it's both accredited and unaccredited in Brazil. It serves both B2C and B2B, and every student in the state of Sao Paulo, every high school student now has access to Alura as well. So it's a true end-to-end life cycle solution for those seeking a career in technology. And I think that is the epitome of what lifelong learning is all about. And then lastly, just to round it out, and we do have other companies as well, but we have a joint venture with Southern New Hampshire University. Monash is a part of it as well. And what we're trying to do there is similar to what Michael Crowe talked about. We're taking American and Australian degrees and democratising access to those for people in emerging markets. We're really trying to meet the student where they're at in terms of language, in terms of culture, in terms of price, and really offering them the opportunity for a quality Western education online delivered at home. And that's a massive opportunity. We're delivering that into Latin America. We're delivering that into India through partnership with our Indian partners, who also happen to own one of the largest private universities in India. And so through that venture, we're also delivering online degrees for domestic Indian universities to currently more than 40,000 Indians, Indian people at the moment. So that's probably, I guess, one more thing. We've got a venture in the UK, which is called My Tutor, which is really about university students helping high school students with their tutoring requirements, all delivered online. My Tutor is one of the largest employers of university students in the UK, and it has relationships with over 1,000 schools in the UK to help high school students access one-to-one tutoring.
That's quite an amazing and diverse range of partnerships and activities in various parts of the world that all coming out of SEEK Investments here in Australia as a single point of contact. And I wonder, Josh, with all that we started today with, which has been this preoccupation we've all had in the Australian sector for the last 16 months or so with the opportunity to rethink, to consult, to develop a new vision, to develop a new accord, and with the overriding message of that being such growth in the need for skills over the next 25 years, and that much of that we hope and might have an expectation will be provided by TAFE or universities growing. But I think it was Sherman, was he painting a picture for us of how big the footprint of Melbourne and RMIT would be? It was somebody. And how unrealistic perhaps that might be, and just what that would mean for us to have face-to-face development in that sort of way, and campus development. I wonder, in making your choices of investments and thinking of your strategies, how much you see growth to meet the lifelong learning needs, not just of Australia, but of 8 billion people. How much of you see that resting in activities of hybrid, online, face-to-face universities and VET providers, and maybe not or, and how much of that you see as other forms of skills development that people beyond those organisations might make and that you would see as attractive to invest in?
Yeah, so I think the key word is and, not or, so you really picked up on that. And I'm a big believer in formal higher education, both in the university space as well as in the vocational space. I think there's room for both. And, you know, if we think about Australia, we're very fortunate to have a very large and vibrant higher education university sector and VET sector. We often talk down our VET sector, but, you know, it's held up as a model by others around the world. It's competency-based. It's got a lot of interesting elements to it. And we have dual-sector institutions in this country, and that's a huge opportunity for growth. So I'm a big believer that a formal education is still the pathway to, let's say, the better jobs, and that was mentioned before, not to every job, not every student needs a higher education, but it's still the pathway to many skilled jobs and that drive the economy and the future needs of the country and the globe, if you like. But it's no longer enough. And, you know, there's now much more space, much more need for other informal types of learning, be it boot camps or short courses or certifications and other things, just-in-time learning that like to go one service, as well as, you know, short, sharp credentials that you can now get on Coursera, for example. And so I believe that there's room for all of these to coexist. And the point is that there's now a need to not only have a higher education to get one of those better paying jobs, but also to have something else to differentiate you, to help you stand out, and then to remain relevant over time. And that's why I refer to the Alura example in Brazil as a really nice way of sort of taking an ecosystem approach, a lifelong learning approach, very much along the lines that ASU and Michael Crow is pursuing. And that is, in my mind, inevitably where we're going. I think one risk to call out for universities in this is that although universities have a natural role to play, it's not sort of a guarantee that they're going to remain relevant over time. And I think that the affordability piece, you can't keep raising prices by inflation or more than inflation every single year at the same time as, you know, the ROI of a degree standalone, let's say, is in, you know, coming to question, and expect that you will continue to find an audience and find and grow your share. And if I look at the US now, there was a stat I read recently that said up to half of parents now are now thinking that a four-year degree is not the right answer for their children. Now, that's a massive, massive shift. And so, yeah, I think higher education definitely has a role to play and should have a role to play, but it's not a guarantee.
So that's a really helpful and interesting insight into how you're seeing the world as you invest in different parts of the world and as you engage very closely with it. It's really hard, I know, from being in senior executive roles in Australian universities, to juggle everything that you've got going on in your institution, to engage with national debates and national policy review, and to stay connected and to continue to have insights into what's happening in not only your own sector around the world, but in parallel developments in the transformation and disruption that's taking place. How aligned do you think what is happening in higher education in Australia with some of the global best practice in higher education strategy evolution and transformation, and in the engagement with corporate ventures in this space? And what more encouragement would you give to higher education leaders in Australia of how they can, if there is any deficit gap that they need to address, how they can best stay engaged with that continuously changing landscape?
I'm conscious that we've got some university leaders here in the room, and let me start by saying that Australian universities have had a great history of being global innovators. And so if we go right back to distance education, we were pioneers in that back before kind of online learning, if you like. If you look at the inroads that we've made in terms of building Australia as a study destination for international students, if you look at the amazing work that OES has done with its partners from Swinburne University through to Monash, QUT, Western Sydney, Federation. These are all examples of innovation. If you look at the work that, the development of IDP that Seek Limited was a part of helping to commercialise, IDP was born out of all 39 public universities seeing an opportunity and going for it. If you look at the success that the Australian universities have had in markets like Vietnam and Malaysia in building foreign branch campuses, only about 2% of all foreign branch campuses globally have ever worked, and most of them have been done by Australian universities. And now we're pioneering again with the likes of Deakin and Wollongong going to India, being the first foreign universities to set up campuses in India. So there's a lot that you can point to and say that, you know, Australian universities, they're not good at everything, and no one is, but they've certainly pioneered a bunch of things. And I struggle with the concept of best practice as a notion, because it feels a little bit like trying to nail jelly to the wall. So I can say that I've pointed to examples where I think Australian universities have utilised aspects or been a global leader. But then I sort of step back and think, well, but what's this change of, what's happening? What are the changes going on? And look at the pace of change in technology. And, you know, I don't want to kind of dwell on AI, but if we just use that as an example, right? And I was reading, some of you might have read in the news this week that NVIDIA, that small Taiwanese company that's now worth about, I think it's the third most valuable company globally behind Microsoft and Apple, have just announced a new chip. Okay, now, you would be familiar with Moore's Law, the idea that computing power doubles every 2 years, and that computers, I think, speed up by a capacity of about 100x over 10 years. You look at what NVIDIA has done in the space of AI. I think that the power of AI, or they claim that the power of AI has increased 1,000-fold in the last 8 years. And their new chip has something like 200 billion transistors on it. It's just ridiculous. And so there was a kind of a question over the last decade with how long would Moore's Law continue? How long would the rate of change of technology continue to accelerate? But that question is kind of now redundant with AI, right? 1,000 times in the last 8 years. And yet then you look at the shape of the Australian workforce and the report that RMIT and Deloitte recently released that showed that, you know, something like half of all Australian workers think that generative AI is not relevant to them. And yet something like 9 in 10 jobs are being impacted by it. And so clearly more needs to be done by all organisations, by all leaders, whether they be company leaders, university leaders, in helping their workforces and their stakeholders adapt to this kind of new reality that's happening irrespective of them. And it's sort of, do you want to be part of the change or let the change happen to you? And I think the realisation needs to be that what made us successful in the last 10 years is not going to make us successful in the next 10. And the biggest danger to change is apathy, or I would say complacency. And that's probably the big call out, is just to watch out for that. And not to allow, not to wait for policy change, not to wait for things, just kind of get on with it as David was saying earlier, as Michael Crowe has done in the US, and recognising what you are able to change. And the big thing I think that leaders are able to impact and change is culture and people. And that is where the heart of the change will come. It's certainly, if you think about what drives change, it's three things, and this was shared by a CEO of our online university in Mexico. He said that change requires empathy, it requires dialogue, and it requires community. And community has been a real theme of today. And if I sort of channel what Jane Goodall said, is that, you know, to really affect change, it starts with listening and by talking to people who are doing things that you think are not right. And I realise that we're talking here to a room of people that are kind of, it feels like we're preaching to the converted a little bit in this room, but the real change happens when you get outside and talk to people that have a different ideological perspective to yours, whether it be in relation to online versus on campus, for-profit versus non-profit. You know, it's through dialogue and through understanding the different perspectives that real change will happen.
Well, that was a fascinating conversation with Josh, and great insights there into how the nature of learning is seen to be changing by people that are prepared to put their money where their mouth is in terms of existing players and new players in the sector. And some great pointers for us to have a conversation with a range of leaders, facilitated by Sue Kokonis, the Chief Academic Officer of a company that Josh mentioned many times in that interview, OES. And we'll hear more from Sue as she introduces those guests and that panel straight after this message from OES, our sponsors.
Short on resources to enhance your university's online learning objectives, OES's collaborative approach ensures program success while offering flexibility across disciplines. Our tailored solutions uphold academic rigour and your reputation. Choose OES for adaptable, high-quality online learning experiences.
Who has is described, she's a chief strategy person at Adobe, but is a pedagogical evangelist. Isn't that an awesome title? I want that title. That's great. Followed, we have Sherman Young, who is the DVC at RMIT. And Sherman's got a background in new media production and is a creative and provocative thinker. So I'm expecting big things from Sherman today. And last but not least, we have Eric Knight, who's joining us from Macquarie University as Executive Dean. And Eric's got a very interesting and distinguished experience in the higher ed sector, having been at Stanford, Oxford, and now at Macquarie, and did a short stint at Boston Consulting just to round him out a bit. So welcome, Eric. All right, let's set the context. I feel that we're in a new epoch, and the epoch is that disruption is the norm. And I think, in fact, Martin Bean's probably written a book that warms to this theme. We've got the Accord with the emphasis on access and equity, and I think we're all behind that. Quite ambitious targets, and we talked about the realisticness in the earlier panels about achieving those targets. To be achieved while in the backdrop of having enormous technological changes. And if we think about it, on the rapid back of having to move to online very, very quickly during COVID, and some of us were more prepared for that than others, we're now in the era of AI and grappling as a university sector, and in fact as a whole sector, as a society, how to use it ethically and impactfully. And we can't ignore it because our students and our future graduates and employees and societal leaders will all be fully embedded in it. So that's the challenge. My hunch, though, is that if we get this right with the technology, that will help unlock some of the access and equity and growth which will build the skills for the future. So that's my provocation for today, and I'm going to throw out a few questions to my esteemed panel. So with the rapid technological shifts that we're experiencing, Sherman, what does learning and teaching of the future look like?
Thanks, Sue. Setting aside the fact that I feel like the supporting band for Taylor Swift coming after Michael Crowe, to answer the question, the cynic in me says not very much different if we don't actually do something. So it's on us to actually grasp the metal. And I want to answer your question by not answering the question, because that's what we do as academics.
That's very Sherman.
Thanks, Manuela. And my sense is we, and it won't be us because we'll be dead, but in 50 to 100 years' time, we'll look back at this period of time around the change of the millennium as a bit of an inflection point, as a shift from what was possibly known as an epoch of print culture to what is now and will continue to be an epoch of digital culture. And the challenge we've got at the moment is that we are making that up. We are figuring it out. Someone in the lobby at Morning Tea said, are you going to talk about online and AI? And I'm not, because to me they're just components of this kind of inflection point around a whole different way of thinking about how we deal with knowledge, how we then construct societies, how we then think about our whole ecosystem of life. So that's kind of the very high, big picture kind of thing. And in that context, in the context of us making something up in a very rapidly evolving time, which could be epoch defining, then the questions around what does learning and teaching look like come into stark focus in a different way for me. So for me, it's not about how to use the technologies, etc. It's more about what is the point of what we are doing? Let's get to the crunchy bits. What are the outcomes we want for our learners? What are the experiences that will contribute to those outcomes? And then using the evolving technologies that we have, how do we best create those experiences for those outcomes? Because the challenge we have is we kind of keep thinking about the future in the framework of the past. Mm-hmm. We keep saying, oh, how do we make lectures better? Mm-hmm. Sorry, Martin, I'm going to swear. Well, screw that. Who cares about lectures? You know, we say, can we have a different semester model? Well, why do we even have semesters? You know, we haven't got the from the get-go thinking that this environment demands us to have. So that doesn't answer your question, Sue, but I think it perhaps alludes to the sense of me being a bit provocative. So
very good, Sherman. I'm going to keep you on the hook a little bit there, okay, though. So we're talking about the outcomes. What are the outcomes that we want?
Yeah, that's a good question. At the high level, we want to make sure that our citizens in the future understand how to live, work and thrive in a digital culture. Mm. It's going to be a different culture, and we can see it happening at the moment. You know, we argue about fake news. We try and figure out what cheating is. We try and understand what authority is, try to build trust in a way that's still deeply rooted in print culture. Mm. But it's a whole different way of dealing with information, and we haven't figured out how to actually address those challenges. And to speak to your questions around ethics, you know, morality, philosophy, all of those things are things that we need to grapple with in a whole different information paradigm. Mm. So one of the outcomes is, how do we do that? How do we equip our graduates with the tools to be able to critically engage with those elements of information, of the new information ecosystem? The second thing, I think, is we actually want our graduates to be able to build that environment in a way that is best for humanity. So one of the high-level outcomes is we actually need the skills, knowledge, experience, abilities to actually have our graduates, or they might not even be graduates, you know, why do we even need degrees? Did I say that? And have them equipped in a way that they're building the tools and the culture that is going to be appropriate for us as humanity.
Great. Thanks, Sherman. Eric, you're itching to jump in.
Well, I was just building on that comment about outcomes. I think we need to have a discussion and debate about outcomes, both at sec level, at the institutional level. Let me be provocative here. Let's think that an outcome that we want from graduate education is a job. We want our graduates to be employed. We did a piece of analysis at Macquarie Business School last year to ask that question of business school graduates. Are they getting jobs? Are they getting jobs at good firms? We didn't have that data. We didn't have that data. And when you look at the graduate outcome surveys that the government collects that data on, has a 35% participation rate, it's a single question, six months after graduation. I think we as a sector actually need to have the conversation of the outcomes, how we measure them, have we got the data sets. From that, an enormous amount arises. But I think things like lectures and technology, these are all inputs. These are not outputs. So I just wanted to be a bit more provocative there.
David Lloyd this morning said we should just get on with it, crack on with it. What are the structural changes we need to make in the higher ed sector?
Yeah, I was thinking about how to put on an American accent to answer this question. Channel Arizona State University. So we actually did sort of blow things up at Macquarie Business School and Macquarie University. As you may know, the history of Macquarie Business School actually has a 50-year history with the MGSM, with our MBA, and we had a Faculty of Business Economics. Maybe familiar to some of you who are familiar with the model at Melbourne University. And we blew that up. We blew that up about 5 or 6 years ago, create one Macquarie Business School. And in doing that, we rethought and restructured every single leadership role in the school. Every deputy dean, associate dean, position description of the heads of department, course directors. And I think that has been incredibly powerful for us in responding to Michael's charge in Arizona State University of turning faculty into super faculty. Because what we know about technology transformation is that technology is part of it. It's how you use the technology that's the really key thing. And how you use the technology is, how do you have really engaged faculty? How do you have leaders of that faculty who are kind of on that? And so we've rethought the really foundational role of course directors or program directors, the people who oversee a Bachelor of Commerce or an MBA, giving them real empowerment to look at the data and make sure the data sets are asking the right kinds of outcome-driven questions, for example. They don't have to be determinative answers, but they're data that prompt questions around, do we have the right course learning outcomes? Do we have the right graduate attributes? And then we have a process, we have a series of conversations, health checks that are grounded in those course directors. Now that seems really, sounds intuitive, but it is about building that entrepreneurial infrastructure, the people infrastructure, that capacity to ask really probing and difficult questions. That, I think, is the essence, because out of that, with that empowerment, come the requests from faculty for new technologies, come the adoption of new ideas. Mm-hmm. So I think it is starting with that entrepreneurial culture and ecosystem, and organisations as information, systems of information flow that allow us to then get into that sort of attempt to blow things up.
It's a culture and empowerment and the data at the right time. We did some work with our academic team and we really asked them what the data is that they wanted rather than giving them the data, which often happens. What do you need? What do you need to respond to the students? And if you want to respond really rapidly, what are the key features? And we iterated over a number of times using an agile methodology to get to that. So I should...
It's turning the passive to the active. How do I make the... Because we know that about learning, but how do we turn the academic or the course director into the inquirer, the person who's asking, not the mere recipient of things that are being sent to them?
Can I jump in there?
Yeah.
So I totally get it. I'm wondering where the student sits in there and how we actually flip it so that we put the student in the centre of that and understand the structure through the lens of the student journey from go to woe, cradle to grave, if you like now, because we're not very good, and I can speak personally and also for my institution probably, is anyone from RMIT? we're not very good at understanding how the student has been tracking right throughout their journey. And we don't have great structures in place to do that. And the way we think about our structures of both staff and infrastructure kind of is focused on our staff and the resources rather than thinking, well, okay, what does that student journey look like and how do we do it? So that's probably where I would start if I could.
It reflects in the classroom, doesn't it? I think it is also about a different mindset for both faculty and students, understanding which roles are the roles that are more important in the classroom, and maybe the professors being more like a guiding the learning journey than being the protagonists, as we saw. But how fascinating that we are in that moment in time, as you mentioned, Sherman, where changes, such highly structural changes can happen. Can I ask a question to Sherman and Eric? As decision makers in this point in time, do you feel more terrified or more excited about this, about the decisions they're going to make?
I'm thinking of the meme. There's a meme about I'm so excited or something. I'm actually really excited. It's a really exciting time. And there's a lot of opportunities, and I think if we don't embrace those opportunities, that would be the disappointment.
I just wanted to launch off something that Eric mentioned before, which is around ecosystem, and we're talking about technology and how it might apply to teaching and learning, and to remind us that there's 700 Australian edtech companies that want to partner with you to help deliver some of these outcomes. They employ 18,000 people all around the world, and they generate $3.6 billion, which is a tiny, tiny fraction of the entire sector. So there's an opportunity to partner with them. But coming back to what does the future of teaching and learning looks like, I hope that we don't talk about technology at some point in that journey. I think it's just part of it. I expect that we'll ignore modality at some point. I don't think we'll talk about on-campus, online or hybrid. It will just be learners or students will be there. And I would encourage us as a sector to encourage government to ask for modality in the surveys they're doing for students. I'd love to see universities seeing what quilt data looks like for online learners and seeing whether or not there's a positive or negative correlation. And my final provocative thing would be I'd love it to have it mandated that if you publish a ranking, you must also publish your quilt data at exactly the same time on the same piece of paper, so that we can elevate teaching and learning in the ecosystem.
There's a few claps from the audience there. David, coming back with Manuela's question about or statement that it's about the student, and given that our students now, if we think about 20 years ago we started talking about digital natives, now we're talking about AI natives, what are the things that we can do for our students to really, really support them using technology in an ethical way that prepares them for the future.
Oh, was that a question to me?
Yeah.
Oh, wow, okay. Just a really easy one to start
That's
with.
That's right.
I don't think that the technology component should change any of the student charters and ethics. It's just it's what you're teaching students anyway. So I don't think adding the technology in there should change that. It should be expected that we're working independently and it's our work and all of those sorts of things. As far as... I forgot the second part of the question, sorry.
How do we ethically harness technology to do this effectively for the student experience?
Well, I think I guess I'm a bit mixed on what I can say to you other than the fact that I think that the core ethics of a human are going to be there whether we've got a technology solution or select technology part of it anyway. Sometimes you put an onus because we're adding technology in there that we need to add a new component to this charter, and I just don't think that's the case. I always channel certain people, and I remember Professor Beverly Oliver, or Emeritus Professor Beverly Oliver, who was a deacon for a long time. She said to me once, just because it's face-to-face learning doesn't mean it's great. Just because it's online learning doesn't mean it's bad, right? Like, let's not evangelize face-to-face learning because it's amazing and fantastic. And my own personal wish, having done lots of online learning in the last couple of years, is if someone could rebuild the social constructivist education model in the online world, I would be very happy. Because PDFs and four-minute videos, a quiz, and then a 100-word response is not the best practice of online learning. I hope there are some people in the room that are thinking far more deeply about that than me.
I'm optimistic, and I know that there are. So that's very positive. Eric, you'd like to...
Yeah, I just wanted to pull up on, David, your point about how can we reconstruct the socially constructivist world inside the technology, because I think that's a really interesting question in the following sense. There's a pilot that's playing out in New South Wales schools called EduChat, which basically takes ChatGPT and brings it into the classrooms. But when a student asks the question, yeah, how do I solve this equation, it doesn't tell you the answer. What it does is it prompts you to ask another question, and it leads you to the process of eventually finding that answer. And the reason that's, I think, important is because one of the technology design attributes for all of the edtech companies out there is to distill what we know about learning, which is challenge and curiosity and making things inquisitive, and making that a feature and not a bug of these systems. And I think that's when the technology becomes addictive. My daughter is massively into math seeds and reading eggs and these kinds of things. They become, because they have distilled technologically the notion of curiosity. So in a way, going back to the tech, I think the tech will become better if it takes those attributes that we know are really critical to learning and make them fun.
Can I just add one thing in there? It's really important to note as well that really successful edtech companies have a very strong focus on an education problem, and they bring educators into the design process right from the get-go. And we do a survey every year of the Australian edtech ecosystem. We're about to publish next week. But 78% of Australian edtech companies have an educator from the sector they're trying to sell to, either on their board or in their C-suite. So they take it really seriously, and they're trying to build tools and technology that is advancing those sorts of learning practices. They're not trying to displace them, and they're trying to advance that. And I think there's some products out there that are doing some really interesting things in helping that digital transformation of that teaching and learning as well, certainly in the K-12 space. Higher ed, I've got less visibility on.
And I might flick to Manuela at this point. Manuela, in your role at Adobe, which could be considered an edtech company, what's the edtech companies, what can you guys share for us as a sector?
I would jump straight away when you mentioned that, because I think it's a moment that also welcomes cross-collaboration more than anything. I couldn't agree more with you, and as a person who impersonates pedagogy at Adobe, it comes to now being a moment where with our strategic partners, we are seeking for inputs in the technology that we are creating and welcoming that feedback at the same time as trying to understand where are the blind spots or what can we bring back as industry to academia to help accelerate that debate. But there's something else that I saw yesterday, an article from ASU, where they were mentioning how not only nurturing the ethics and discussions about the use of GenAI is, of course, top of mind for every institution, and students should be exposed to Gen AI tools to be able to be critical about it. But what about educating staff, professional staff, academic staff, and students on the Gen AI itself as a technology? And without doing that, we won't be able to opinionate on if it's a policy adequate or not. We can only fear what we don't know, right? Or at least to an extent of how we calibrate our fear. How much should we fear Gen AI? How much do we actually know about the machine and how it actually works? We cannot make decisions without understanding that. So ASU, in this article, they were mentioning how they were doing like lunch sessions to all staff, explaining how large models operate, how Gen AI actually, how is the technology behind it. So I think it's a combination. And to your question, I think it is from us, from the sector and academia, coming together and understanding how can we advance this debate. And I believe we are both open for that, which is fantastic.
And I'd like to change. That's an absolutely important thing about educating our staff so that they can co-collaborate and work very closely in this area. In terms of how do we guide this effectively, any thoughts on that?
I'm happy to jump in. So when we talk about education and technology and all of the accumulated conversations around it, I think we have to unpack. There's probably three things we're talking about. There's education about the technology, so that's the technology as a discipline, what it means, the materiality, the ethics, how to build it, etc. There's education for the technology, so in the technological environment that you end up with, the information ecosystem that I was talking about, how do we educate our students for that? And then there's education using the technology. And that's how do we actually, to your point, Manuela, train our staff and make sure that we actually use the technology in an appropriate way. And I think sometimes when we have those conversations around technology and education, we conflate those various conversations. So we start to talk about ethics, et cetera, and we almost try and insert that into everything in a way which it should be inserted, but it's a conversation that needs to happen almost in a privileged place so that we have a very clear position so that we can then educate for and educate about. And I think for us, there's very clear needs, and coming back to the real world after that kind of theoretical diversion, for us there's a very clear need to partner with our technology companies. But we take the very firm view, even internally with our ITS colleagues, that the business of education needs to lead the technology implementation. And it's not the other way around. It's we will only use the tool that solves the educational challenge and meets the outcomes and experience that we're after for our students. Because sometimes it's kind of like the what tail is wagging the dog, or the whatever analogy you want to use.
And building off that, and this is a question that I really like to sort of unpack, what part makes sense to have a human in the loop, and what part makes sense to have AI or AI or whatever technology we want to use? What part makes sense? Any thoughts on that?
Yes. So there's a kind of a strand of thinking in Gen AI which is are we building a tool or are we building a creature? And I very much lean on the we are building a tool side of the fence. So at a very high level, I think humans should be in the loop almost always. Having said that, there are probably level one inquiries around where's the swimming pool, where's the library, etc., that we could very happily delegate to a chatbot. But as it stands right now, I think that we absolutely need to have the AI tool as a supporting aid for the human.
I wanted to just go back one little step and talk about partnerships across the sector, because I think it's an important component. And I'll share with you that EduGrowth designed a program which was funded by the Victorian government called the Global Victoria EdTech Innovation Alliance. And in essence, what we did was connected EdTech companies, education institutions, universities, TAFEs, or schools, both in Victoria and offshore, with researchers to actually look at the efficacy of their product over a six-month period and see whether or not it had an impact on those learners. The outcome of that program was an $800,000 grant got turned into more than $12 million annual recurring revenue for those companies. Eight of those projects resulted in commercial transactions, which means those institutions saw a benefit to then go and enter into a commercial transaction. And those companies went on to raise about $12 or $13 million worth of capital to support them in that process. The reason I mention it is because there is a very easy way to connect EdTech companies, education institutions, and the researchers that you have within your institutions to drive the thing that's driving the adoption of EdTech across the world, which I hope is driving the EdTech adoption, which is efficacy and impact on the learners. We saw in the pandemic this huge wave of bloatware going to institutions, enormous adoption of EdTech, and I hear all the time right now trying to pair it back, like Sherman said, to things that are making the impacts that you are actually desired to do. And I'll finish with the AI piece, which is part of our survey. We ask EdTech entrepreneurs to think about where they're seeing AI in their businesses and what that might look like in the sector. And it won't be surprising to this audience to know that more than 50% of them think that institutions will be the slower part of the market than the commercial market, and that they 60% of them think that, in fact, the education sector will be a couple of cycles behind other verticals for very good reasons. I think there's very good reasons why there needs to be slower adoption. But I think AI is going to be moving so quickly, I'm not sure that we can wait for all of the frameworks and all of the testing. We are going to potentially leave a cohort of students behind unless we adopt quicker.
So, David, what can we learn from outside the sector?
I was thinking a lot about this when you posed this question to me the other day, and the only answer that I can come up with is if we look at verticals outside of education and we try and think about the amount of digital spend those verticals spend in their industries and what we do in education, it's incredibly hard to find how much money a university spends on digital within their institution. But there are some ex-VCs in the room who can probably give us some insights over lunch and they can tell us what their institution was spending. But I went and pulled out some data for us. So HolonIQ is an intelligence platform for education, and they published data which says about 5.4% of spend in education is what's spent digitally.
And how does that compare to industry?
Well, you will not be surprised to note that Gartner suggests it's about 12.8% on most other verticals that they're spending on digital services in their industry, which means we are at least one magnitude back, right? We are at least 100% behind, maybe even a little bit more. And the thing that I think about, and the piece that I think about, is we spent the morning talking about the Accord, and one of the things that popped into my head was 800,000 students to 1.8 million in 24 years or 26 years was the prediction. And I thought, how much of Melbourne is Melbourne University and RMIT going to consume if it's all face-to-face? And so it just demands a digital response. Like, it feels like it's not an and-or, like it's just going to happen.
Can I just build on that? Because I think the one partnership that I think is catalytic in this that we haven't talked about going to outcomes is employers. I mean, the labour market process that takes someone from a student into job, which is some of the status stuff that Michael's talking about, is incredibly inefficient. I mean, people use university brands as a proxy for quality. And I do think we need to think about disrupting that. I think that there are really interesting things that a LinkedIn or a Seek, you know, can do into that space. And I'm sitting on the Business Council of Australia. I think it's fair to say that the employers, yes, they can't find talent. Yes, they're not very good at looking for it either. and they use all these kind of biases and attributes into that. And I've just mentioned two companies that are just Australian, right? And this is a global employment market here. How are we working with the LinkedIns and the Seeks of Asia? So I just think that in partnership, if we're going to really drive employment outcomes, if that's one of the attributes we want to focus on, we need to get the employers employers and they need to work with us, and it's got to be... And that was, for me, one of the bits that was missing in the accord. It was, yeah, got the government, got the universities, but the employer voice was probably a bit, to me...
It's a little subdued in the accord, isn't it? Yeah.
Can I ask you a question on that, though, just before we finish? What role does industry have in paying for that training?
Me?
Yeah. Like, yeah, I get that we want to have them in the system. It just feels to me over the last 20-something years we've expected the public to pay for all of that education when the employer should be part of that.
Employer should be key to that. And I think about that in the context of this lifelong learning piece, right? So if I've got a person at level A who I want to get to level B, level C, level 3, and I'm the employer, I should be helping either develop them inside my organisation or training them to lift up. And I think that that is an example of investment and intelligence. You know, when you break away the some emerging companies like Culture Amp in Australia, for example, and others, they're effectively kind of learning businesses. But I think there could be a much more open conversation around that.
And there's whole different models. So there's a few of us in the sector who are doing things with higher apprenticeships. So you get the job first, and then the university provides the learning through the job. And that's a model that I think will increasingly go in the UK. It's quite significant. But in the UK, it did require quite a significant funding effort from government. Here, where we aren't in that position, but we should be able to think of innovative new models like that to help.
Thanks, Sherman. Manuela.
No, I'll just say that then again, a new structure is required for that as well. That the whole learning and teaching model has to be rethought.
As a couple of questions from the floor. One question from Michael Burgess. The sector is notorious at investing huge sums in enterprise systems. Read clunky. That's my insert. That don't shift the dial. Thoughts on this and how we can change? Open to the floor.
Sigh. Yes, we are. And the tension is that universities are multi-billion dollar businesses, and there's a level of enterprise risk and control and governance that comes into play, which often results in a default towards an enterprise system. That's the reality.
That's sucking up our 5% of investment.
Can do. But to be fair, and anyone from Microsoft here today, but we also need our enterprise partners to come to the party to reduce that 5% because education pricing isn't what it used to be.
Good challenge there. We're talking a lot about access and equity as one of the elements to meet our employer needs, and we've talked about employers being part of that. With the digital, if we are becoming more digitally focused and using that to enable our students to succeed, it's a bit of a two-edged sword, isn't it? How are we going to ensure that 15% that we keep talking about, that is the gap between those who go to university and those that we need to go to university to meet those skill shortages, how are we going to ensure they're not left behind because of technology?
Can I do a ScoMo and challenge the premise of your question?
Sure. Actually, not my question.
Whoever's question was, sorry for the political...
It's anonymous.
I'm not sure that everybody needs to do a full university degree to get those skills. So the question we have to ask ourselves is, what is the outcome and how do we provide the appropriate learning? Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like a... We don't... It's not the same hammer. That we need to wield for every challenge. And we need to be nuanced about that.
I mean, another way of thinking about this, and I've been thinking about this in an indirect way, I mean, I know Glyn Davis, in his idea of university, talks about the uniformity of universities. We talk about that. But there's an incredible diversity in the secondary education system in Australia between so many different types of schools and students going to that path to university from so many different launch pads. So I do think the technology and the equity piece is about lifting a student who's year 12 at this regional school or this Catholic school or this independent school to a point where they can both all be successful. And I think that's a potential opportunity. That sort of first, last mile, last 2 miles, last 3 miles. There's enormous diversity in our secondary space.
Can I just, you know, if we look at one of the biggest disruptions that I hope I ever experienced in my life, being the COVID-19 pandemic, can we pause for a moment and say, I can remember Belinda Tyner when she was DVCE of RMIT writing a post about having to go and buy laptops for students in first year university at RMIT, and I was like, really? Wow. And then I was on a panel, in a task force, and one of the anecdotal things we're hearing is that there was just no technology available. You couldn't actually go to Officeworks or to JB Hi-Fi and actually buy something. So I think that the digital divide is real, and we sometimes paper over it, and there's absolutely no way at the moment that we're addressing that from any way, shape or form. So the thing that I think about is this idea that a university, for example, might shut down ChatGPT within their school environment. What student doesn't have 14 other devices they can connect to 14 other different systems and run ChatGPT next to them? So therefore, if there's one student that can afford $20 a month to buy ChatGPT, whatever it is, 4.5 or whatever the latest version is, so what is it?
4 turbo.
Okay. And then the other who doesn't have access to it, I wonder whether that's just compounding this digital divide. And I don't think that we're thinking about even how we even tackle that idea at the moment. There were kids who didn't have... The Victorian government had to buy dongles to send them out so that there were 30,000 students who just didn't have access to them. And that was a drop in the ocean. So the digital divide's real.
So without blowing our trumpet, we've built an internal version of ChatGPT-4, which is available to all our students for free.
Awesome.
So Sherman's solved it. Thank
for
you.
Us.
Another really good question coming in from the floor. The Accord noted the failure of job-ready graduates and disadvantages for the humanities. And this is a great question to ask. In an AI world, do we need the humanities, philosophy, ethics and arts more than ever? Who'd like to take that up?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think by what Sherman was saying, if we see AI and new technologies as our tools to serve us, the human aspects become the most interesting part of it all. And that's what we will be thirsty for. It is about curiosity, communication, critical thinking, empathy. It is about those aspects that are utterly human. And then, again, technology is just an accessory to make our lives easier and give us free us time, which is the most scarce resource we all have.
Great, thank you. And Martin's back up on the stage, which means we're nearly about to transition to another fantastic speaker. But last rapid-fire question for the panel. I've got you all. I've put you in a time machine. We're coming out in 2030, not too far. What is one thing in your life that is radically different to now because of technology? And Eric, we'll start with you and work back.
Well, 2030 is not far away. I think there's a very strong drive towards personalization in everything, you know, in the tech that I am using. And I do worry in my own mind whether I am going to become more narrow-minded as a result, because it's all sort of narrow-casted. So that's one thing that I do think about.
So 2030, Eric, is a little more narrow-minded.
I could be living in my own echo chamber more than I am today.
Hopefully not.
Can I come and join you?
Thanks, Eric.
Sorry. In 2030, I hope to have a pair of glasses with cameras and a screen so that when I look at someone's face, I don't need to remember their name.
We'd love that. Manuela.
Oh, have you watched that movie, Her? From Spike Jones. I think I'm done on having a personal and professional assistant who take care of all my mundane tasks, and I have a lot of free time to do things that I love.
Great.
I think by 2030, I've got a much smaller ambition than these. I just would like my wife to use Google Calendar so we can have a shared family calendar. And she refused. She will only use Outlook. That's my really simple goal. If we can get an AI bot that can translate...
By 2030, Google will have deprecated calendars. So.
Oh, okay.
Thank you, everyone. It's been a fantastic question.
Tell us by 2030.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
2030 for me, I don't have a huge aspiration. I want to walk into a room and all the AV just works. Just like that. Not too big a ask.
So you can't say that when we've got all these techs at the back of the room and all fingers crossed at this stage in the show. It's been working perfectly, and that's worked perfectly as a panel. I'll just make two comments before I invite you to join me in thanking our panel and thanking Sue as the facilitator. That question about the humanities Some of you might know Paul LeBlanc, the outgoing president of Southern New Hampshire University. We might talk about him a little bit later. He was a guest on my podcast just about over a year ago and has built a quite astonishing university that's entirely online as a scholar of the humanities. His comment about the place of humanities in a new AI world was that he saw it as a reinvigoration and a reimagining of the humanities and that they have come of age. Don't know if I got all of the professions exactly right, but he talked, I think, about he'd be happy enough to give out to an algorithm for financial advice, but he'd want a human to hold his hand when he came out of an operation. And I think there's a lovely connection there with a number of things that you asked, Sue, about, you know, are we going to use this as a tool or are we going to see this as taking over our lives in some way? Taking over some parts of our lives where it's welcome, perhaps, but not getting involved in the parts of our lives that are really important to us, where we really do need a human dimension. And the other comment I'd make about something that Eric said about, I think this panel has been so good, and I think this whole session has been so good, because dare I say, 16 months, 408 pages, and 47 recommendations, there's a lot of things that there aren't enough of in it, as well as lots of great things in it, but tech is something that there's not enough in it. And I think this has been giving us some interesting pointers to that. But Eric's comments of something else that I think is missing from it is enough input from and responsibility on employers. And I'll just connect us back with how we started with Michael Crow and all of his data about billions of research and income and students. One of the things that they've just ticked over at ASU is their 10,000th graduate sponsored by Starbucks. So when you're next in the U.S., go to a Starbucks anywhere in the country and ask someone behind the counter, are they a student of ASU? My sampling will tell me that you'll find yes in 60 to 70% of the cases. They're graduating their 10,000th fully sponsored student to do online, largely business education of Starbucks employees. And the general demographic is 31-year-old single mother of three. And then think about why that relationship with an employer exists. It's because Michael went to Starbucks. And then think about what responsibility we have to act and to act quickly.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that episode of HeadX. It was a fascinating insight for me from the live event that we had in Melbourne in March. Through the eyes of a major investor, through the eyes of a major ed tech company, and her facilitation of a panel of really leading edge thinkers in business schools, in technological universities, and from a range of global providers of higher education systems and services, and those that are nurturing that ecosystem here in Australia and other parts of the world. I think there's a huge number of pointers there for providers of lifelong learning, for how they might go about embracing technology in their leadership, for how technology will change the nature of our business. And with that point at the end there, the critically important role that providers of learning will develop in partnership with employers to really make that transition happen. But that's all we've got time for this week in HeadX. Until next time, thanks very much for joining us.